From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farming Country. I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. It's Saturday, January 17th. Well, this morning, we are heading to Calcoon to visit the very cute, the very fluffy, and very curious sheep of Old Long Farm.
They literally bounce across the room when they're excited. And when they're nursing, their tails go fluttering back and forth. It's really adorable.
Alex Gardner is the owner of Old Long Farm. And we talk about what it's like to raise sheep in Sullivan County and how he turns sheep wool into yarn. Plus, Rosie Starr talks with retired National Park Service's Don Hamilton about how ice forms on the Upper Delaware River. All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report, but first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A federal judge in Minnesota is restricting federal immigration agents from retaliating against protesters in the state. NPR's Jasmine Guards reports the decision follows weeks of heated protests and confrontations in the city of Minneapolis.
The judge ordered federal agents not to retaliate against people, quote, engaging in peaceful and unobstructive protest activity. She also ordered agents not to use pepper spray or other crowd dispersal tools in retaliation for protected speech. Minneapolis is the latest target in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Homeland Security says there are over 2,500 ICE agents on the ground. Protests erupted last week after an agent shot and killed 37-year-old Renee Macklin Good and have continued every day since. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, Minneapolis.
A special election is taking place in Northern California this year that could further chip away at Republicans' slim majority in the State House of Representatives. North State Public Radio's Andre Bayek reports.
California Governor Gavin Newsom announced that the election to fill the seat left vacant by the death of Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa will happen on August 4th. That's later than the June date many observers expected, which would have coincided with the state's already scheduled primary election. And it leaves a currently safe Republican House seat vacant for at least the next 6 months. LaMalfa was a 65-year-old rice farmer from Butte County, about 70 miles north of Sacramento. He was closely aligned with President Donald Trump and died suddenly from an unspecified medical issue on January 6th. The winner of the special election would serve just a few months before having to run in a newly redrawn congressional district. For NPR News, I'm Andre Bayek in Chico, California.
Iran's supreme leader is accusing the United States and Israel of sparking violent protests that caused what he called the deaths of several thousand people and massive damage over the past 2 weeks. NPR's Jana Raff reports from Amman.
Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's statement appeared to acknowledge that thousands of people have been killed in the protests. Iran's foreign minister said last week the deaths were in the hundreds. A U.S.-based Iranian human rights group says it has verified more than 3,000 deaths, most of them protesters, in demonstrations sparked by Iran's collapsing economy, much of it due to U.S. sanctions. Khamenei said while Iran does not want war, it will not let domestic or international criminals go unpunished. President Trump had threatened Iran if protesters were killed, but said this week that the killings had stopped. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
This is NPR.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Kimberly Izar. New York Governor Kathy Hochul made New Yorkers a promise during her State of the State address on Monday.
We're promising universal pre-K for every single four-year-old by 2028.
But in Sullivan County, its child care assistance program has been closed for more than 6 months. The county has not accepted any new applicants or recertifications since July of 2025, saying it doesn't have the funds to reopen the program. In 2023, Hochul significantly expanded who is eligible for the state's child care assistance program, and that's made it easier for more than 100,000 families to access affordable child care, says Hochul. But Sullivan County Health and Human Services Commissioner John Little says expanded eligibility has created new challenges.
The eligibility has expanded so much that even if we can as Orange County did, open up just to folks who are renewing, we've still tripled the size of this program over the last 3 years. And so no matter how long we open it for, we're not going to be able to open it for very long.
Even with increased state funding, Sullivan County has exhausted its rollover funds from previous years, leaving many families uncertain as to whether they'll receive state child care assistance anytime soon. Little says he's not feeling optimistic about what he heard from Hochul's State of the State address, especially given the uncertainty with federal child care and family assistance funding. Hochul is expected to release her state draft budget later this January. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izarm. So one of the things that I have been learning to do this winter is winter cliche. I'm learning how to knit. It's something that I've always wanted to learn how to do. And it's been honestly a joy to be so new at something. And I've been starting really simple, learning how to make little squares and just getting the basics of making neater stitches. But along this very beginning part of this journey, I've been thinking a lot about where yarn comes from. And I can't think of a better place to learn about that process than here in the Catskills. I recently chatted with Alex Gardner. He is the owner of Old Long Farm and who raises sheep in Calicoon. The farm's name is in honor of the Long family that farmed there on the property for a very long time. And I was fortunate enough to meet some of the flock. That's the sound of Alex Gardner's sheep munching on some grain treats. He's holding a bucket of grain that he's delicately distributing to his flock.
This is Betrayal. She's one of our oldest.
And that's Betrayal, one of the sheep at Longwool Farm in Calicoon, New York. He and I spent an afternoon in January together talking about raising and tending to his flock, as well as the extensive process of shearing, cleaning, spinning, and selling sheep wool yarn. Here is my conversation with Alex Gardner of Long Wool Farm.
So I'm Alex Gardner. I grew up in Vermont, and I worked with sheep when I was in high school, but just with a lady down the road from me. And when we moved to Calicoon, this is an old dairy farm. It's most people know it as the old John Long Farm. And it was this barn that we're standing in. My neighbor, Sally Cregan, told me that her grandmother kept getting recognized as having the cleanest dairy barn in the county. So we felt we had to do something with it. We had a lot of land that needed to be cleared. It was overgrown with roses and brambles. And since I love sheep, we have a barn, we have fields. So we got seven sheep in the midst of the pandemic. We got seven sheep from a lady upstate. They're all Shetland. They're pure Shetlands. And two came pregnant. So we went from seven to nine the very first year. The other ewe who was pregnant, we weren't able to save. The lamb was breech, and so we weren't able to get him out in time. So we went from nine, and then one of the lambs was a ram. You can see him back there with the curly horns. That's Easter. He's castrated now, but he was our ram for 2 years. And so we bred him with the other ewes, and they all had twins. So we wound up, we doubled the size of our flock within a year. And then we got some more from Amy and Wes, like I was telling you earlier. Yeah, and then we bred again the next year. And so now we have 32 sheep.
Tell me a little bit about the personalities of the several dozen sheep here. Yeah.
So Shetlands are very curious. They're very relaxed. They're a little wary. Some of them will let me come right up to them and pet them. They'll eat out of my hand if I give them grain. They don't like to be startled. You know, they're prey. They're also herd animals. So if one gets spooked, then they all run away with them. So managing, one needs to be, you know, very slow and very quiet and very gentle, because they're very gentle animals. They really, when they like to be pet, they're like dogs. They just want to be scratched on their butts and behind their ears and on their necks and on their noses. And they're very sweet. They meet each other by sniffing each other's noses. So if you put your face down, they'll sniff your nose.
Tell me a little bit about some of the favorite things that come to mind when it comes to raising and tending to Shetland sheep.
Lambing is really, I think, the high point of the year, because the lambs are so joyful. They literally bounce across the room when they're excited. And when they're nursing, their tails go fluttering back and forth. It's really adorable. They are perfectly happy to be picked up and held. They like to play. That's really the most joyful part. I think sheep are aesthetically beautiful. I think a field with sheep standing on it, eating, is just a really beautiful sight. I mean, I grew up in Vermont, but and Vermont used to all be sheep farming before dairy took off in the early 20th century. Vermont was all merino sheep. So, I mean, I didn't really see sheep much in Vermont. I saw cows, but I don't know. I feel like it's in my blood that there's sheep around. I also love the smell of it, the lanolin on your hands when you, mm-hmm. after you pet them or after you work with the fleeces. My hands get so covered in the lanolin. It feels mm-hmm. like I've just put on as much moisturizer as I can find.
It's so soft. I remember the first time I ran my fingers through sheep, and all of that moisture, so soft.
Yeah, it really makes the best hand cream if you can get anything with lanolin in it.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about the process. I know you mentioned that you had sold some of your yarn down in New York City. Tell me a little bit about what that process looks like.
Yeah, so it's pretty involved. So most sheep get sheared once or twice a year. There are breeds of sheep that don't get sheared because they have hay or hair that falls out. The first couple of years we had them, we only got sheared once a year. But now we do twice a year because their fleeces grow so fast, mm-hmm. and it's just better quality. It's softer. There's a lot less waste. So we have a guy, Jim Powers, comes down and shears twice a year in the early spring and in the early fall. He gets them up on their back and he shears them. Takes about 5 minutes each sheep, just with his electric thing. It's really quite amazing to watch. it's a beautiful art. And then they run off. And so then what I do, it's called skirting. I lay out the fleece and I pick out the bits of hay. Now that we do it twice a year, there's very little waste. There's very little. But when I had to do it once a year, the fleeces get so long, they get burned by the sun, they get full of hay and brambles or burrs, get covered in poop. Mm-hmm. So I would throw away a lot. But now that it's twice a year, there's very little to throw away. Then what I do is after two or three shearings, I put it in bags and I bring it up to Battenkill Fiber Mill, which mm-hmm. is up sort of near Saratoga. And it takes about a year and a bit to process. They turn it into yarn for me and then send it back. And I knit with it. I give it away or I sell it in New York.
Oh, I didn't realize it took a whole year to process. Yeah. What kind of, do you know what kind of goes into that?
It's a pretty involved process. So first you have to wash it. Then they do what's called carding, which is essentially getting all of the fibers in the same direction. You can do that by hand. It is incredibly labor intensive. And then once you take that, it's called batten or carded fleeces, and that then goes into a spinner. And if you're hand spinning, you take a little piece and it goes into a hand spinner, or with a big, huge machine, it's all going in one direction and they spin it into the yarn. Oh. Yeah. So one of the reasons I got the two new lambs from Amy and Wes is that they're brown. Almost all of my sheep are black gray or white. And she, their fleeces change over time. Like this ewe, she's sort of second to the back. She just looked out the door. Mm-hmm. She's got a split ear there where her tag got ripped out. So her name is Star. She was jet black. And now, 4 years later, she's quite pale.
Yeah.
Her fleeces are quite pale. So you'll notice that some of them have horns and some of them don't. The ones that have horns are all castrated males. They're called wethers. And I pointed out Easter before. He's got those magnificent horns that curl because he was intact, as they say, for a couple of years as our ram. But then he figured out that he could jump a fence, and so he couldn't really stay a ram because I didn't want him impregnating everybody whenever he felt like it. You know, I wanted to control that process.
Alex, anything else you might want to add just about the yarn making process, raising sheep, that maybe we haven't already talked about?
Well, one thing I really like about having sheep is how it's really connected me to a lot of the other farmers in the area. Like, yeah. I've gotten to know farmers in ways that I wouldn't necessarily have otherwise. Like, my neighbor Dale Hess up the road has sheep, and Chris Herman down the street makes hay. Mike Henke on the other side of the hill makes hay. You know, I have to buy my hay from the closest person because it's a drag to carry it or, yeah, you know, transport it. But I've met a lot of people who are making hay and really, you know, I've always, having grown up around farms, I've always had an appreciation and a respect for farmers. But now that I am literally dependent, you know, for the welfare of my animals on these farmers, I even more gratitude for them.
Thank you again to Alex Gardner of Old Long Farm. This was just such a joy to be around the sheep and see all their different personalities. So thank you again for the invitation. Up next, you know what time it is? This week's Star Talk Report from Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. The winter circle is composed of 7 bright stars spanning 6 constellations. The winter circle is centered around the most conspicuous constellation in the winter sky, Orion. Orion dominates the southern sky throughout the night during winter. To find the winter circle, locate the brilliant blue star Rigel on the lower right side of Orion. Travel clockwise to find the southernmost and brightest star of the winter circle, Sirius, in the constellation Canis Major. If Sirius is at the 6 o'clock position, then the next star, Procyon, is at the 8 o'clock position. Procyon is the brightest star in the constellation Canis Minor. At the 10 o'clock position lie the duo Castor and Pollux, the brightest stars in Gemini. Heading up to the 12 o'clock position is the northernmost star in the winter circle, Capella. Capella is in the constellation Auriga the Charioteer. Auriga resembles the shape of a house that we all drew in grade school, with Capella being the bottom right star of the base of a house whose roof is inside the winter circle. Continuing around the circle, we arrive at Aldebaran, the star that marks the angry red eye of the bull in Taurus. Going from Taurus to Rigel completes the winter circle. The winter circle is high enough in the southern sky to be seen around 9 p.m. and can be found in the evening sky through the end of March. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Well, in our second half of the show, if you've been driving along the Upper Delaware River, you've probably noticed that lots of the river actually have huge ice blocks. And, you know, there's so many reasons why ice blocks form in certain parts of the river versus others that don't have as much ice. Don't forget that the river is 73 miles. And to help us understand here on Farm and Country how the climate affects the Upper Delaware River, Farm and Country contributor Rosie Starr chatted with retired National Park Service Don Hamilton to learn more.
Don, please introduce yourself and tell us where you live in our community.
My name is Don Hamilton, am retired here as the Natural Resources Program Manager for the National Park Service on the Upper Delaware River. I've lived in the area for 32 years. For most of it, I've been in that position here with the National Park Service. I came here to take a job with them. The Delaware River is such a gem, and I've really come to appreciate it and all the values it represents. And I've had the privilege of working on it and learning about it and its natural resources over the years. And so I hope to maybe share a bit of that knowledge and to help develop people's awareness, understanding, and appreciation for this magnificent resource we have here in the Upper Delaware River.
Yes, I'm honored to sit with you because I know you have this knowledge and I'm anxious to share it with our audience. Every once in a while, we bump into each other at different events and we talk about silly, important things like the ice forming on the river. And we actually had a lovely conversation on River Road one time about it was very early winter and the ice was just forming. And we shared an experience that we've both have. I learned from the Hocker family, which has a lot of history in Milanville, that the word splosh is the sound that ice makes on the river when it's just forming. It's a skin. And you said to me you had a word, I believe it was frazzle. So let me hear about your word, frazzle.
Okay, well, yes, I live in Milanville, Pennsylvania, and Calkins Creek flows along one side of my property, and so kind of feel a little bit connected to the river right there. But I've always been kind of fascinated how ice forms on this river. It's different than how it forms on lakes, which is what I experienced where I grew up in Michigan. But on a flowing river like this, you have very cold weather, super cooled conditions. You will have a type of ice called frazzle ice that begins floating along the surface. And these are ice crystals that kind of form little rafts, and it kind of looks slush-like. Where those get caught on objects, they'll kind of lock in place, and then you'll have surface ice freeze in place on the river. And that day I met you on River Road, Rosie, and we were looking at the river ice. We were looking at the upstream extent of it from Narrowsburg, about a quarter mile upriver from the bridge. And this is typically how it freezes. This frazzle ice floating on the surface will catch on some object or kind of get some constricted area like the Narrowsburg Bridge, and it will back up and form upriver from there. And we were looking at kind of the leading edge of that at the time. So it's kind of a different process than on a lake, but it's kind of fascinating and something that I have always taken an interest in, having done a fair amount of ice fishing growing up. River ice is much different than on a lake. It's uneven and it's kind of jumbled up in places that you really have to be very cautious about getting out on river ice, and because it can be uneven and it has a flowing current beneath it, and you really need to know what you're doing. So, and there are open leads on the river where you will have areas that aren't ice covered, and it's just a very dangerous thing to try to cross the river under those conditions. And I've seen a few deer try to do that, and not all of them survived. So there are places like the Big Eddy in Narrowsburg, where the area on the New York side, where you don't have much, if any, flow of water, you'll have thicker ice form like it does on a lake. And I haven't been out on that ice, but I've seen ice fishermen out there. Any river ice, you should really go out with a spud bar and check out how solid it is before you venture out on it, and never try to cross this river, even though it looks like it's fully ice covered. It's a dangerous thing to try to do.
Well, that being said, should we have a little more reverence for George Washington and his troops trying to cross the Delaware?
Yeah. Well, that was in December, Christmas Eve, and it was downriver. But if you look at pictures, paintings depicting that, you'll see them crossing and fending off ice, chunks of ice with poles. And I've often thought that, you know, maybe an example of climate change. We don't normally see that much ice, that thickness on the river. And of course, that was well downriver south of us. But still in December, we don't very often see weather that cold and ice that thick having formed on the river.
Do you have some fond memories of being in Michigan? What was it like as a child? Was it a lot different than winters here?
It was dependably more snowy because I grew up in Traverse City in the northwest part of the Lower Peninsula on the west side of the state. And so we had a lot of lake effect snow there. So it was dependably more snowy. Other than that, the weather wasn't that much different in terms of being cold. You do have more sunny days here in the wintertime and less snow, and but temperatures are similar. A lot of things about that area and this area are similar in terms of the climate and the plants and animals, and this area is more mountainous.
You probably share this also. If you're lucky enough to live here and the winter's been cold and there's lots of ice on the river, there's a special effect when the ice breaks. There's an actual ice out that people stand on the bridge and watch these chunks of ice floating down. Have you ever experienced that and the sound that makes?
Oh, yeah, that's kind of memorable. In fact, I thought it was kind of interesting when I first moved here and saw people setting up lawn chairs on the Narrowsburg Bridge and for the ice out. It was an event that really drew a lot of people. And I have stood out on the Skinner's Falls Bridge and felt that ice going through below, and actually the bridge would bounce a little bit from the force of it. But that's why the Roebling Bridge has these ice breakers that extend out from the piers to break up the ice and prevent any damage to the bridge piers. And all these bridge piers in the river are designed to cut through the ice. Some of them have a piece of metal on the upstream side of the bridge pier to protect them from the ice. So it's, definitely something that has to be designed for a river like this and ice out.
And there's more reverence that we can have for the bridges in our area. If they're over 100 years old, 100 winters of ice and snow, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, bridges have to be designed for those conditions. And yeah, there's special engineering that goes into that. And they have a predictable lifespan because of that.
Thanks again to Rosie for that conversation. Rosie Starr is going to be bringing us new, fresh stories from up and down the Upper Delaware River each month, so stay tuned for that. Before we sign off, just a few things from our community calendar. Tomorrow is January 18th, and the Mamikating Environmental Education Center in Wurtsboro will present a Starting Native Seeds workshop from 1 to 2:30 p.m., The workshop will demonstrate why native plants are important to a healthy, biodiverse ecosystem, and folks are encouraged to bring a clean gallon milk jug or seedling tray or pot. You can find more events in our listening area on our website at wjffradio.org. That is all for this week's show. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it is Catskill Character with Donna Fellenberg. You are listening to Radio Catskill. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Morgan Outdoors. Celebrating 20 years as a local source for hiking, snowshoeing, and discovering the great outdoors. on Main Street in Hurleyville, near the rail trail. Morgan-Outdoors.com.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Paula Poundstone summarized the brand new government food pyramid.
They want you to eat.